What happens when a pagan king uses the name of the Lord in vain? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. This week we are continuing our series on the biblical book of Isaiah. My conversation partners are Jody Washburn, Matilda Fry, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. We are all speaking through our masks today, so it won't be as crisp as we were in pre-virus times. Now, today's lesson, the defeat of the Assyrians, is one of the most amazing stories in Scripture. It tells about the attack of Sennacherib against Jerusalem and the death of 185,000 Assyrian troops. Now, as we read this narrative, and it's told in Isaiah 36 to 39, Matilda and Jody, what comes to mind are the crucial issues that we face when we read this story? What about the supernatural?
Well,
death of 185 by the stroke of God's hand.
Yes, that is one part of it that is surely discussed among Bible scholars and questioned. The great number of the people who of the Assyrian army that in the biblical text is said to be destroyed, where it is difficult to have those find those records, and there is different evidence for this battle in from an archaeological survey.
One of the interesting wrinkles in this is that Sennacherib's army was down at Lachish, and they have had a mass grave there discovered with 1,500 fatalities. Now, that seems to be more reasonable. 185,000, that's a bit on the high side. What can we say about the use of numbers in the Old Testament? Is there anything we can or should say?
It's tough because there are some instances where it's clearly rounded numbers are used. In this case, it feels so specific, it makes it hard for me to say, oh, we should just say this is a rounded number. But it does seem to be the case that the point being made in these texts about who's sovereign, right? Is the Assyrian God sovereign or is the Lord sovereign? It seems that that point stands regardless of where we fall on the argument of was it exactly 185,000 and did they die from a plague or did they die from this or that? It seems that that overarching point stands either way, whether we say it's a hyperbolic use of a large number or whether we try to say it's exact measurement.
But Jody, when you what can you say, for example, about numbers that are used in ancient records that are just as great, like great big numbers placed there for the sake of making the king, for example, to look good, to look great, to look big? The use of such numbers is for propaganda purposes and for showing that the power in charge has all the authority and power there. So is it possible that in the biblical story, God, when God is depicted as the greatest, that the numbers are great as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what you just said about the fact that these texts are written for the purpose of depicting the power represented in a certain way is absolutely crucial. Because when we read the Assyrian accounts, of course, they're going to depict primarily what makes the Assyrian king look strong, sustainable power, like victorious. And we have here a text that, again, things have been selected, right, to present the God of Judah as authority, strong, victorious. And both are selecting, you know, what to include and what not to include. And I think that that sort of the idea that this is an annal or a historical record, but with it's functioning in a certain way, right, to portray power, yes. that can't be overlooked.
You know, there's an interesting comment from C.S. Lewis on this one. And I'll just read the quote here. It's from his book, God in the Dock. When the Old Testament says that Sennacherib's invasion was stopped by the angels, and Herodotus, the Greek historian, says it was stopped by a lot of mice who came and ate up the bowstrings of the army, an open-minded man will be on the side of the angels. Unless you start by begging the question, there is nothing intrinsically unlikely in the existence of angels or in the actions described to them. But mice just don't do these things. So I think there are a number of perspectives that we can look here, and the total number involved and the supernatural acts are both serious, but if we admit that God can, in fact, perform miracles, then it seems to me we've got a fairly clear trajectory that we need to go. Now, my opening question said, what happens when a pagan general misuses the name of Yahweh? Because as you read the biblical account, it's amazing how the Rabshakeh came up and says, it is Yahweh who's told me to do this. You've not been honoring Yahweh, and he's told me to come and do this. Is that misusing the name of Yahweh, the name of the Lord, in ways that would get ordinary believers in the Old Testament in trouble?
Seems like a pretty straightforward awareness of the regional nature of deities in the ancient Near East. You know, the sense that each area was understood to have their deity or deities. And some, you know, some cross boundaries. But when I read that, I see just the wider understanding. They were aware of what deity was considered sovereign in Judah. And so, of course, they're going to speak using that language. I find it interesting, too, that the Rabshakeh, like, in a way, is echoing words from other parts of the prophetic literature, you know, talking about Egypt and how dare you rely on Egypt, who is like this splintering reed, and using this some of the imagery of weakness or
but he's also speaking, he's not just using the name, he's speaking in Yehudit.
Yep.
So that the people would understand. That means this high official of the Assyrian king speaks Hebrew. Why would somebody who is the official of the most powerful king at the time speak the language of this small people group? And yet he does here. So several scholars argue on this and say that this official could well be one of the descendants of the deported Israelites who had been already taken into Assyrian captivity earlier by the Assyrian kings from the region of northern Israel. So he speaks the language, he uses the name, and he brings in biblical theology. He is not only referring to the power of the king and to nations that the Assyrian king has overthrown, but he speaks of trusting in this Lord. Yeah. Do not do that, he says, and so on. So where does he get those ideas? In the language. So is it possible that he is one who knows?
That's a fascinating observation. Now, there's another aspect here, and I don't know how much time we have to dedicate to this, but it's very interesting that, I mean, we will sometimes refer to the Lord as Yahweh, but almost none of our modern translations use that. They will simply say Lord. And in some cases, they will put the Lord in all capitals as kind of a secret signal that this is how you know that there's original Yahweh. What's the source? How did that get started so that there's such a reluctance to use the name of Yahweh in referring to Israel's God?
Well, we see it in the development of the writing of the name, certainly. I love the observation that many scholars have made that the word that we read as the Lord, all caps, like the God of ancient Judah, it is related to the Hebrew word to be. So the ultimate being. And I mean, it seems early on, like if you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, they write it differently, for instance. So they tried to separate early on this name and take out the vowels. And, you know, we read it with different vowels. And I don't know that we even know how it was originally pronounced.
Yeah. It is, for, as far as we understand, for the sake of reverence towards the presence of God as this being who is in the covenantal relationship with his people. Mm-hmm. And the name is not expressed, but a substitute is put in that is the literal, has the literal translation Lord. And so we get the translation Lord, but with all caps, because of Yahweh as that tetragrammaton that we have no real understanding how it was expressed.
I wonder if it's related to the, you know how in the ancient world the oaths, self-curses, were considered to either bring about a blessing or a curse, like through the spoken word? And if it was used or misused, you know, the outcome could be different. I wonder if that's tied in somehow with the understanding of how his name could be used.
That could be. One of the things that apparently led to it is that when Israel was taken into captivity, they finally began to realize that it was because they had broken the law. So they took steps to make sure that the phrase is, built a fence about the law, so that they would not transgress it. And when it came to the command, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, they said the easy way to do that is simply not to use his name.
Hmm.
And so that's really how it got started. And I think that it's really very helpful when you read the Old Testament to know a little bit of that inside story. And so that we can recognize what's going on there. Well, our time is up, and I want to extend a grateful thank you to Jody and Matilda for their contribution to our conversation today. My thanks to Luke Irvine, who assisted with the recording, and to Rick Baskett, our program engineer. He's the one who puts things online for us. A grateful thank you to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.